Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. Very special guest this week. Served as a Metropolitan Police Department officer in D.C. And was fortunately for us and unfortunately for him at the Capitol on January 6th and was literally on the front lines defending our political system and our Constitution and our Capitol and us as Americans. Michael Fanone, who has a new book out, Hold the Line, The Insurrection and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul. Michael, it's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for your service and thanks for your service all these years and what you did on that day. It was really amazing. And this book is incredible and glad you wrote it. We'll talk about the book, but in general, I kind of want to ask you, after that day, has that day changed your view of America, humanity, our political system in any way, shape, or form?
Oh, absolutely. I've completely changed. It's given me a totally different perspective on this country. I mean, I had a very small world prior to January 6th. Now I've been exposed to so many different things, so many different people. And it's made me realize, I think, unfortunately, how much we as Americans have taken for granted our democracy and how much we have become lazy with our vote and support of our political leaders.
Hmm. Almost, do you think it's because people just become indifferent because they feel like caring doesn't make a difference? The system is bigger than they are. The powerful are the powerful, and the little person doesn't really have a say in anything anymore.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think that unfortunately, many of us have been manipulated by our politicians, by our political leaders, by political parties, when they don't seem to have policies that will benefit their voters. They've opted for to engage in this culture war to try to get people more engaged in support and voting. And yeah. I mean, unfortunately, we've seen the result of that. It's torn the country apart.
That seems to be one of the reasons you wrote the book, almost like a call to action, right? I mean, you kind of obviously hit on what happened that day, but what was sort of the larger goal that you had in writing the book and what you want to sort of get through to people through the book?
Well, I mean, there were two main topics that I tried to address in the book. Obviously, one of them being, my experiences on January 6th. I divided the book up into three parts. There's before, during, and after. The during, obviously, is the day, what I experienced that day, and then also what I observed. The bravery, the courage, and the selflessness of so many other police officers that responded, despite their political affiliations, none of that came into play. These were cops that went to the Capitol that did their job. We're fighting for each other. We're fighting for democracy. But I also wanted to address, my experience afterwards, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Everything that I encountered, the indifference from lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle, but I mean, obviously, most often from Republican lawmakers, simply because the activities of January 6th, they deemed them not to be politically advantageous. Mm. And so what you've seen is, the vast majority of them ignoring that day and trying to focus on other issues. And then you also have, what I've called the fringe members of the Republican Party, the tinfoil hat brigade. These are the Paul Gosars and the Marjorie Taylor Greens and that Andrew Clyde's and Louis Gohmert's and even Senator Ron Johnson, people who've engaged in mischaracterizing the day, lying about the day, using micro events, like a picture of people walking through the statuary hall to somehow represent or reflect the entirety of that day, which, you know, obviously, if you watch my body-worn camera footage, which I released pretty early on, you can see how brutal that day was.
Oh, God. Yeah. When it was going on that day, I mean, it goes south really fast. What was going on minute to minute as it was escalating to the point where that there's a just brutal attack on you and others? Were you approaching the Capitol going, okay, well, this is going to be a little bit of a crowd control thing? And then did it just, take me through sort of some of those moments as it escalated to that sort of really terrible point.
So again, I remember the day, pretty vividly. The morning, and we're talking about like mid, late morning, I remember hearing reports from officers that were on the scene of the actual rally, the Stop the Steal rally, which took place on the Ellipse, just outside of the White House grounds. And there were reports coming in from officers and MPD assets that were, embedded with the crowd that saw individuals who were armed. There were reports of individuals with, semi-automatic handguns. I mean, we heard the radio transmissions as part of the select committee's investigation. You know, there were reports of individuals who had AR-15 style rifles. And that's when I knew that there's definitely something different about this day. But it wasn't until early afternoon when I heard reports from officers at the Capitol over my police radio that police lines had been breached, that officers were under attack, and that they were falling back further and further away from the outer perimeter up to the Capitol. And so at that point, when we started hearing an abundance of 1033 or distress calls coming out from U.S. Capitol Police and also from my department, I made the decision that I was going to, rather than engage in my normal duties that day, which I was planning on conducting a controlled drug purchase as part of an investigation that our office was involved in. I said, no, we're going to respond to the Capitol. And so for the first time in over a decade, I put a uniform on, and my partner, Jimmy Albright, and I went to the Capitol.
You were working undercover at that point, doing this potential drug buy. Knowing that there were semi-automatic weapons and handguns sort of at the rally, those people couldn't be stopped, I guess, or from getting to the Capitol, or they just overran?
I mean, there were arrests being made, but I mean, obviously, law enforcement, it's not as simple sometimes as just going in. This is not I guess for lack of a better term, a typical scenario in which an officer observes an individual who's armed with a firearm. And right. Obviously in Washington, D.C., we have pretty strict guidelines with regards to carrying firearms. And so you're dealing with a crowd, a massive crowd, crowd that is angry, a crowd that is armed. And so while arrests were made, it's impossible to facilitate the arrests of, much like the attack on the Capitol. I mean, people ask me all the time, like, why weren't more people arrested that day? These officers were fighting for their lives.
Yeah. And they're Capitol Police there to most of the people there were just there to protect the building and do, there weren't enough bodies to do major arrests like that. There just weren't enough people to do that. Right.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, there were deployment issues with regards to the U.S. Capitol Police, even before the actual violence started to occur. But, for the most part, law enforcement was greatly outnumbered that day. In some scenarios, 3 or I've even heard as high as 5-1. And, in a situation like that, the last thing that you're focusing on is you know, conducting arrests.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're just trying to secure the facility and like I said, fight for your life.
There's been a lot reported on this, and I personally watched all the hearings. What happened in those moments and on that day that we don't know or that hasn't been discussed a lot? I mean, are you sitting there going, I cannot get over how angry these people are? How is this happening? Moment to moment, when it really starts, when you rounded that corner and you just saw the mayhem, what's going through your mind? Obviously, protect the Capitol, hold the line. But are there some larger thoughts going on for you? Or did you observe some things that we have not heard a lot about yet in those moments?
I mean, I want to talk about, you know, what I observed in the tunnel, which I think, I don't know if people understand the intensity of the fighting that was happening there. I mean, I've said this was, you know, this small, narrow tunnel became the, you know, funnel point for, you know, a mob of 15,000 people who were trying to enter the Capitol. And you literally only had 40 or 50 officers in that tunnel protecting it. And what I saw was I saw police officers who under normal circumstances would have been, you know, evacuated medically and sent to the nearest hospital. But that was not an option. You know, we were surrounded, we were cut off from two sides, and all we had to do to survive or, you know, our only option was to continue fighting. So you had officers that were self-triaging. You had officers that were rendering medical assistance to their fellow officers. Themselves were injured, and then picking themselves up and getting back out onto the line. And literally recycling, you know, the most injured for the least injured, and that constant flow. So, again, like I said, the level of courage and selflessness that those officers exhibited, I've never seen anything like it in my 20-year career policing. And I, you know, it angers me to no end that those officers have not been individually recognized for, and in reality, no one has been appropriately recognized for their efforts on January 6th.
Why do you think that is? I mean, everything happens for a reason, especially in a city like that where everything's very calculating. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that, in my experiences from talking with local lawmakers, members of the city council, I remember a conversation that I had with one of our local council members, Brianna Nadeau, and she told me that, you know, when she had tried to advocate at a local town hall meeting for some type of acknowledgement for these officers, that she was actually shouted down. And, you know, she told me, never underestimate how much people hate the police in Washington, D.C. So there's that angle on behalf of, you know, Democratic lawmakers, who you would think would be aligned with honoring these officers, if for no other reason than, you know, cynically to take shots at Republican lawmakers. But they weren't, because they didn't see it as politically advantageous. And then you have Republican lawmakers who are denying or denouncing the reality of that day. And ultimately, they're beholden to Donald Trump. And so why would Donald Trump want to honor or acknowledge these police officers? So you really have created an environment where this, you know, subsect of the law enforcement community, the guys that went to the Capitol on January 6th, have been abandoned by everyone. And that's very difficult. I mean, to kind of comprehend as an officer who almost lost their life. And there were, I'm not the only one. There was 50 of us in that tunnel. How do you come to terms with the fact that, you know, you did something so superhuman and unbelievable, and you're essentially being shunned and admonished for, you know, for having done that?
Yeah, it's disgusting and inexcusable. I'll tell you that. I mean, I just want to touch on one last thing. You make reference to you voted for Trump in 2016. But you had a close friend, a black informant, a transgender HIV positive woman, and that relationship helped you mature and rethink your methods as a police officer. When did that happen, and what do you mean by that?
So Leslie, who I write about pretty extensively in the book, Leslie and I became friends pretty early on in my career. I would say within the first year that I was working at the Metropolitan Police Department. Like you said, she was a Black transgendered sex worker. She was drug addicted. She was HIV positive, and she predominantly worked in an area which I was patrolling at the time. It was a public housing project called Sturgeon Corda in Northwest Washington, D.C. And, you know, we got to know each other early on. It was she became an informant of mine. But I got to see a side of American life that I was never exposed to growing up. You know, I'm a white kid, grew up in the suburbs, spent my time hunting and fishing, was not particularly a fan of, inner city living. Mm-hmm. And I got to see how, you know, Americans who live well below the poverty line, Black and brown Americans, what that experience is like and how they fight to survive every single day. And so I came to understand people differently, specifically the people that I was involved in arresting. I mean, there's a lot of bad apples out there. There's some bad people. There's some evil people. There's some people that commit crimes for no other reason than they enjoy a life of crime. But there's also a lot of people that commit crimes to survive. Yeah. People that sell drugs to support their families, people that sell drugs to feed themselves.
So it sounds like this made you more of a sympathetic person in general, and a little bit more understanding about sort of mankind in general and for the better.
Yeah,
I'm still a
rule of law kind of guy. In that respect, but I also, you know, Leslie helped me retain the understanding or the being able to see the people that, you know, I was arresting as human beings. And I think that's something we don't talk about enough in law enforcement. It's one of the other issues that I talk about in my book is, you know, policing, police reform, and officer wellness. Police officers engage with the public on a daily basis. We see people at their worst all the time, all day, every day, in addition to dealing with our own personal problems. And what a toll that takes on officers and how, you know, that can result in some of the things that we've seen play out publicly a lot of times. Like, I'll give you an example that, you know, George Floyd being murdered by Derek Chauvin. Mm. I remember when that came out in the news, I remember seeing people say, you know, this was racism, it's a racist cop. I don't know. That very well may be. Derek Chauvin may have been racially motivated, but I didn't see any evidence of that. What I saw was evidence that Derek Chauvin completely lost sight of George Floyd's humanity. He didn't treat him like a human being. He treated him like an animal. And I don't know if that was something that was predisposed in Derek Chauvin, or if as a veteran police officer, did he succumb to the pitfalls that many officers do, which is losing sight of the humanity of the people that they interact with. And what can we do in the future to prevent that from happening, to save a lot of American citizens' lives, and also to prevent police officers from, you know, from having to experience that. Now, I think Derek Chauvin is exactly where he deserves to be.
Yeah, but I see what you're, but I see what you're, yeah, yeah. And I see, but I see what you're saying. It's like, you know, people need to remember that these are human beings on the other side of this and treat them accordingly. I think the book is fantastic and would love to be able to talk to you more. So we should explore having you back on, because there's a lot more stuff I'd love to talk to you about regarding this and sort of the bigger picture issues. So, we're going to be back in touch to have you back. But the book is Hold the Line, The Insurrection, and One Cop's Battle for America's Soul. Michael Fanone, thanks again for your service and everything you did that day. And I think you really, you know, making lemonade out of lemons in terms of being able to take some of these experiences and your point of view and put it out to the larger population. It's really important what you're doing. So thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.